This is the Daily Connect on RNIB Connect Radio. Have your say on the issues that matter to you. Call now 0345 602 0025. Email radio@rnib.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Connect podcast for Thursday, the 24th of January, 2019. Stephen Scott still on holiday this week, so it's Chris Wallace with you on the podcast today, and what a show we have in store for you. We will be chatting to Brian Anderson from RNIB. Do you live in the Portsmouth area and could you give some valuable time to help change the lives of blind and partially sighted people? Simon Polly is chatting to Brian from the South East Networking Panel to find out how you can make a difference. Also, Glenn Flatley is telling us about his employment. When his sight loss got worse due to retinitis pigmentosa, he thought his career was over, but a chance meeting with a blind man helped him achieve more than he ever thought he could. And InfoSound have been investigating the comments group VI Talk, who are an interactive social network for visually impaired people. A chance to reach out and connect with other blind and partially sighted people, not only online, but in person on link days. Roland Myers from InfoSound is chatting to them.
The Daily Connect podcast.
But first on the podcast today, we are finding out all about Gordon Anthony's new book, Hunting Icarus, which is due to be released on audiobook. Gordon is not only blind himself, as well as enjoying writing, he also listens to RNIB Connect Radio. Great news, Gordon. He's chatting here now to Robert Kirkwood, and we'll have an introduction from Red Sail.
Gordon Anthony is the author of several historical novels, including Hunting Icarus. Set during the latter days of the First World War in what is now Iraq, it follows the lives of two young flyers, one German, one British, facing each other over the desert. Their flying machines may be primitive, but aerial combat is just as deadly as that in the trenches. It's a gripping tale, and there's also a story behind the talking book version. Gordon joined me down the line from his home in Scotland to tell me more.
I wanted to let people know that the war in the Middle East with the British Army is not a new phenomenon, and I have always been particularly interested in the air war, or the First World War. It's just been an area I've studied a lot out of personal interest. So I eventually came up with this story, which essentially follows two pilots, one British and one German, who are both sent out to Mesopotamia under various political manoeuvres. I'll try and cover the political scene a little bit as well. But it follows their adventures and their opposition and the pretty dreadful conditions that they both operated in. And I try to show both the differences and also the similarities between the two sides and the difficulties that they all faced together, and really the futility and the dreadful waste of the First World War.
The historical knowledge that comes through it is fascinating. It's clearly very, very well researched. I know that you too suffer from sight loss, and I think one of the things that I found very difficult when writing is to be able physically to do that research. How did you go about doing it?
Well, as I say, I've had a lifelong interest, and it's only in the last 10 years or so that I've lost my sight. So I'd read many, many books beforehand. And of course, you know, technology is pretty wonderful. I wanted to reread some of the old books to refresh my memory on things. And I also investigated new books that I could read. So I was able to download them onto my Kindle, which reads the books aloud to me, which was great. It was a case of trying to, you know, having to stop it occasionally and take a note. I must remember that part, you know, that's important. And basically filling my mind with as much as possible. On the technical aspect of some of the aircraft, which are, of course, very difficult to recall, I mean, how do you remember the maximum airspeed and the maximum endurance of a particular plane and so on? I did many, many years ago, when I was still at school, I bought a couple of books which listed every single aircraft which flew in the First World War, no matter which side produced it, and it had a brief outline of the aircraft service and the technical specs. And I was quite fortunate that what I did was I gave these books to my mother and said, type those out for me. So it meant that I did. I have a whole host of a folder on my computer with a whole host of technical documentation, and I can look up any particular one and find out the details of a particular aircraft when I need it. But I think the historical background is one of the most important parts of any historical novel. I mean, the story is the main thing. You've got to have a story, and you've got to be able to. They're written for entertainment, but they're also written to inform. And if you get the historical background right, then I think that comes through, and the readers appreciate that you've done your homework, because there's nothing annoys me more than reading a historical novel. And I've read some First World War novels, and I read it, and I'm like, that's not right. And it puts me off the story, no matter how good the story is.
You have lost your sight, I believe, to retinitis pigmentosa?
That's correct, yeah.
But you've also used some of the skills that you learnt in your long career to go out and talk to audiences about sight loss and contribute your own rather wry sense of humour to what can, as we all know, be a very painful process. I rather love your book, A Walk in the Dark. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I wrote that a few years ago when I could still see a bit. I mean, obviously you're registered blind, people don't realise you still have some vision, but I was going through the stage where I knew I was going to go blind and my vision was fading rapidly. And I just wanted to raise awareness of it a little bit. So I wrote a very short booklet, really, of some of the adventures that I'd had. And I tried to put a humorous spin on it because my way of dealing, everybody deals with it in their own way. My way of dealing with it is always to try and make a bit of a joke out of things that go wrong. Now, that's not to say I don't have my moments, because I do. You know, sometimes I'll get really, really frustrated or upset if I do something stupid or whatever. But generally, I do try and make a bit of a laugh at it. And the family help in that respect as well. So, yeah, I wrote that booklet and I put it up on my website, but I've also got it on the Kindle store. I put it at the lowest price I could put on, and any royalties that I get from it, I send on to RNIB. So if your listeners are interested, buy a few copies, that'll generate a few more pounds for RNIB.
And you've also mentioned your family. You've clearly got a very supportive family, and I know that your sister Moira is actually responsible for having Hunting Icarus made into a talking book. She raised the funds for it, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She did an absolutely fabulous job. Yeah, my family generally are very supportive. It came about because I was asked by RNIB Scotland to give a talk. They were trying to raise awareness of talking books, and because I've written several novels, and only one of them was at that stage in the talking book library, I gave this talk, and Moira came along to it to help as one of my sighted guides and just to listen and give a bit of support. And when she was there, she actually, after the talk, she had a chat with Angela Preston of RNIB Scotland, who had organised the thing. And Angela is one of these people you speak to, she persuades you to do things. And Moira volunteered to try and raise some money.
It was a daily ritual designed to keep the frontline troops exhausted. The trench lines were usually quiet during the day because most activity was carried out under cover of darkness. When night fell, men would crawl out into the mud between the lines to lay and repair barbed wire fences or to raid the enemy's trenches. Such raids were terrifying ordeals when men armed with coshes, knuckle dusters, Mills bombs and revolvers would attempt to cut a path through the enemy wire and capture an unprepared soldier from the other side. Except that the other side was never unprepared.
Andrew Loudon narrating Hunting Icarus, written by my guest Gordon Anthony, which is talking book number 24289. And you can find other books by Gordon Anthony, including his memoir of blindness, A Walk in the Dark, online wherever you buy your books.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Do you live in the Portsmouth area? Could you give some time for a valuable panel from the RNIB? If so, you could be helping to change the lives of blind and partially sighted people. Simon Pawley is chatting to Brian Anderson from the South East Networking Panel.
Now, the Royal National Institute of Blind People, or RNIB, is asking for people in Portsmouth to join a network panel for the South East. Now, the panel will work with the RNIB to help change the lives of people affected by sight loss. But what does it really involve? I'm joined now by Brian Anderson, who's a community facilitator with RNIB. Hello.
Hello, Simon. Hi.
Now, tell us a bit more about this actual opportunity then.
First of all, Simon, it's an opportunity for people right across the South East network. So we're going all the way from Kent through East and West Sussex into Hampshire, up to Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire, Berkshire and Surrey as well. And what we're trying to do is the Connect community down here is very active. We lots of people are involved with groups, individual groups, and people are linking up among themselves. But what we're really looking for are people who want to step up a little bit and join a network panel or a committee who represent the community to RNIB and actually make us a little bit more accountable for what we do down here, make sure that we're meeting the needs of blind and partially sighted people across the communities, and that we're really just doing what they want, not doing it to them, but doing it with them.
Yeah, because sometimes a national charity can't always keep up with the nuances that occur in different parts of the country.
Absolutely. We've found that across our region, there are different levels of provision. There are different pockets of isolation for blind and partially sighted people. So some of our bigger counties, there are people who don't naturally gravitate towards the big towns and the centres where perhaps the local society has a base. They're out on the very often on their own, and they don't even know that there are other blind and partially sighted people around them. So what we want is a panel who direct us, who tell us what members of the community actually want us to do, how we can guide things and make things, just make life better all round for blind and partially sighted people down here in the South.
And again, this is RNIB addressing the fact that over the years, sometimes there's been the criticism that it's kind of telling blind people what they should be doing, whereas this is giving the blind and partially sighted community a chance to actually take some control over that, isn't it?
That's true. We're finding now that the old image of RNIB is changing rapidly. We're doing some really good work with local societies in the southeast. We're welcomed in. We're not seen as any sort of big brother trying to do this. We're working together with people to shape the future and just make things a lot more accessible and a lot more interesting for blind and partially sighted people. But what we actually really, really need is for some members of the blind and partially sighted community, not just people with sight loss, but the people who support them, family, people who provide services for them. We want them to step up now and actually join with us in this group who direct and tell us what they want us to do in the future and how we can change the way we do things to be more appealing.
So for somebody who's thinking this might be interesting, what kind of time commitment is involved with this?
We intend to have a minimum of 4 meetings a year. Each meeting will take place around in various locations around the counties, or we'll do things over Skype or by teleconference, and we'll provide people with the support they need for that. Outside of those 4 meetings, there may be subcommittees. It really depends on what the panel wants and how they want things to make it move forward. RNIB, of course, will facilitate all of these things. We'll provide the administrative support that people need. If people need training to learn to use Skype or to use the teleconference facilities, we can help them out with that. And if there's, you know, if there's a need to travel to a meeting in around the counties, then again we'll help out in terms of that, just to make sure that people really aren't disadvantaged by the place they live or by their ability to get about out and about.
So how do you actually apply to get involved with this then?
It's very straightforward. I would prefer it if people would do it by email. We have a mailbox set up, so it's connectse@rnib.org.uk. Or if people want to, they can give me a call, and my work number is 07702509293. And I'd be really happy to talk to people about the way forward for this.
Give us that number again, please, Brian.
07702 509293. You may need to leave a message because I work part-time as a community facilitator, but I will get back to people if they contact me on that.
And is there a time limit on this?
We've set a closing date for the end of January for people to make the initial application. What will happen then is, once people have expressed interest, we'll ask them perhaps to write about 250, 300 words about themselves and what they have to offer. And then it'll go to, we've already established a working group who are going to help to set this up. We drew that from people who already engage with RNIB, and that working group will send out invitations to people to join the panel.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing how that all works out. Brian Anderson, Community Facilitator with RNIB, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Simon.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Do these titles mean anything to you? WTF with Mark Maron, Serial, This American Life, or David Tennant does a podcast with? If so, you are part of a growing community of people listening to and subscribing to podcasts. Even listening to this Daily Connect podcast, you're part of the community. Maybe you find you're listening to podcasts more and more these days, perhaps to the detriment of your audiobooks. Well, we want to hear from you. Which podcasts do you listen to and why? Billy B on Twitter has already been in touch. He says, I listen to several podcasts relating to topics I have an interest in. For example, wildlife, sport, technology. Sacrifice my audiobooks for them? Never. We can do both and enjoy both. Sue Mead over on Facebook says, I listen to podcasts such as In Touch, Friday Night Comedy, FS Cast from Freedom Scientific, as I am a JAWS user, Tech Talk, of course, from RNIB, and The Archers. I like to listen to them between audiobooks. I like to listen to them whilst doing other things around the house. And David Aldwinkle has been in touch also on Facebook. He says, I listen to a lot of podcasts. It's a big replacement for magazines and newspapers for me, as I can't read them anymore and miss getting into detail on sport, movies, politics, comedy, and loads more. They are a great leveller too, as I can talk about them with friends, which I can't do about written stuff. We are looking for more of your thoughts on podcasts. Do join the conversation for a chat later down the line here on the Daily Connect. You can get in touch with us via email, radio@rnib.org.uk, or on social media. On Twitter, we are @RNIBRadio, or you can find us on Facebook, RNIB Connect Radio.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
When Glenn Flatley's sight got worse due to retinitis pigmentosa, he thought his career was over. However, a chance meeting with a blind man helped him achieve more than he thought he would.
The amount of comments I read from people on social media who ask about employment, about worried about having to leave the job and how they can retain their employment, or how they can change careers, what careers they can do, or generally just how they can even get a job. I think it is quite an important subject, and one I felt strongly about, and I've had those same fears, and thankfully I managed to overcome them. It took quite a bit of tenacity and willpower, but I managed to get there. Basically, when I was 19, I found out I had a degenerative eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa, RP. Nobody else in the family had had it. It was a shock to us. I was the only one, along with my brother. The two of us were diagnosed with it. And as I say, we'd had no history of visual impairments in the family before, so it was a shock. And I was 19. I was working at the time, but couldn't really be told how long I would have my sight for, how quickly it would deteriorate, whether it would deteriorate in younger age or older age. So I couldn't find any answers to any questions. And basically, my sight deteriorated quite rapidly. I had quite an aggressive form of RP. And so by the time I was 30, I'd lost almost all of my sight. So when I found out in my early 20s, I was working as a leisure attendant in a leisure centre. My job involved setting up equipment, setting up trampolines, putting them away, putting nets onto goalposts, putting them away, badminton courts, setting up function room for weddings and things. So it was a lot of visual aspects to the job. And as my sight deteriorated, the job became harder and harder and more difficult to do. And eventually I got to a point where I decided that I could no longer work because it was difficult for me. I didn't know anything about the support I could get. I hadn't heard of Access to Work. I was not in touch with social services or anybody. And so I left work and my wife carried on working. I was a stay-at-home dad. I had a daughter at the time who was sort of a year old. And stayed at home for a while. And after about a year, I was completely fed up. I thought, is this what life's got in prospect for me? You know, I wasn't getting out. I wasn't ready to have a guide dog or a cane at the time. And so came quite isolated, just staying at home, minding my daughter. As I say, she was 12 months old. And after maybe 6 to 9 months, a year, I was completely fed up. And so I decided I needed to do something. I spoke to a few people and I went off to try and get some new skills at the RNC, Royal National College for the Blind in Hereford, which was a big decision because, as I say, I wasn't married. I just got married, and I had a young daughter. And to leave them behind and go and live in Hereford for a year was quite frightening. I was 29 years of age. But I'd done it. I went off to Hereford. I'd never used a computer at that time, but I got some JAWS skills, got shown what a computer can and can't do, started learning to type and done some basic skills, and also decided then that I would train as a masseur simply because I didn't know what else to do, and that was one of the courses that was an option. And friends at the college were also trained to be masseurs. I thought, well, that's what I'll do. I'll just say at that point that when I first got dropped off at college, when my wife dropped me off and I was left there that first night, it was a horrendous experience because you're suddenly away from home. You start to sit on your bed on your own, not knowing anybody, head in your hands, thinking, this is awful. You know, I'm not ready for this, but I stuck at it because I had a young daughter who was only 18 months old at the time. And I went through the first year of college, started to really enjoy life at the college, came home every weekend, enjoyed life. I was supposed to be in Hereford for 2 years, trained to be a masseur and Indian head massage and different remedial therapies. And after a year, I was contacted by guide dogs to, I'd put my name down at that point, had sort of accepted visual impairment and realised I needed a mobility aid. And they contacted me just before the summer break. And this would have been in 2000, contacted me just before the summer break and said, we've got a dog for you. Would you be interested in training? And it fitted in with me being back home for the couple of months that you break up from college. And so I went to the guide dog centre. At the time I had to live in, so I've been away in college for a year, came back home to Merseyside. But at the time it was your training was 3 weeks living in the centre. And so although my family were only 3 miles away, they had to come and visit me. So again, I was back home, but not living at home. So again, it was difficult. But when I got to the centre, enjoyed the training. But I'd realised at that point, becoming a masseur wasn't really for me. It wasn't something I enjoyed doing it, but it wasn't something that I knew I would work as, or that I thought I would find it difficult to find meaningful employment at the time. And so started asking for some advice. And I asked the guide dog trainers if they could speak to me about employment, but they didn't really know much about what advice they could give me. So they asked a couple of their rehabilitation workers who were based at the centre if they'd come and speak to me. And they also asked the chief executive of what was then Liverpool Voluntary Society for Blind People if he'd come in. His name was Jim Moran. Jim was totally blind. And to be honest, it was Jim's advice that really made me be able to take things on board and get on with changing my life. And Jim spoke to me about, Jim's totally blind, and he spoke to me about what challenges he'd had and what course he took in life. And he said to me, had I ever thought of training as a rehab worker? And I said, at the time, I didn't even know what it was. You know, I'd had a little bit of rehab and some mobility training with a cane in college, but didn't know much about it. So Jim explained what the role was. And my first question was, well, how can I do that if I'm blind? And Jim went on to explain, well, there's a lot of the aspects of the job that we can do when we're blind, and we can also get support from Access to Work with a support worker to do the elements of the job that we find difficult. So I said, well, it sounds really interesting, and, you know, how do I do it? And he told me that the rehab course at the time was in the University of Central England, in the university there in Birmingham. And so he said, this was in late July, early August, year 2000, and I think it was 2001, and he said, get on the phone and call them up. And so immediately after I'd spoken to Jim, I went away and thought, yeah, this is something I'd really like to speak about, a bit more about. So I called the university, and they said to me, we're full. Admissions is full for this year. They said, we are looking to introduce a home-based course from next year. And I said, no, that's not for me. If I sit at home again after having managed to get the courage to go away and get to college, I said, if I go back home, I don't think I'll ever really get back out again. I think I'll maybe do the course, but won't have the confidence to leave the home again. I need to do something in a college or university setting. And they said, well, we're full. Well, I wouldn't get off the phone to them. I suppose this is where I needed to become a little bit tenacious, a little bit pushy. And I said, well, no, I want to come down and speak to you and tell you how much I want this. And they did agree to see me. And so I went to Birmingham with my wife, had a chat to them. And I think they realised how passionate I was about wanting to get into employment and get a career. They offered me a place on the course, and you needed to find a work placement. And Jim had already said to me, if I was managed to get a place on the course, he would give me a placement. And so that was part of the battle. So I got the place at university, and it was upheaval. It was then moving from Hereford to Birmingham. And again, that first night going to Birmingham, again, I was in a house on my own. And I thought, I've got to do this because I've got a young daughter at home, and I need to make something of my life. And I don't want to being at home and not working just was something that wasn't for me. I needed to keep busy. And at the time, I'd have taken any job would have done. So, you know, the option of doing the rehab training was something I thought, yeah, this will be good. But as I say, any job just to keep busy would have been important. So I went away to Birmingham again. I adjusted to life, made new friends, was in university again all week and came back home at weekends. And by this point, I'd been away for sort of 18 months. And it was, to be honest, it was placing quite a lot of strain on our marriage because my wife was at home as a single parent, trying to work, trying to look after our daughter. I was away in university, and it was difficult times, but times that we both knew had to get on with and try and do in order to make a better life for us. And eventually came to do the work placement with Jim and Bradbury. It's now called Bradbury Fields. It was previously Liverpool Voluntary Society for the Blind. And completed my work placement with them and qualified as a rehab officer. I then hit another barrier, as I didn't really want to move away from the area I live because we had a lot of family support, and yet there were not many rehab jobs in Liverpool. Bradbury Fields, as it's now called, was a good place to work. They had a good rehab service, and the rehab workers that worked there tended to stay for many years. And so the only option was for me, if I wanted to work in rehab, was to go away and work somewhere else in the country. But that wasn't for me, and so I started looking for other roles. And my rehab training, the knowledge I'd gained about sight loss, I had my own knowledge of sight loss, but I quickly learned on the rehab course that it's a lot wider than what you know yourself. When you start learning about other people and how they deal with sight loss and the difficulties they can face, you suddenly realize you think you know everything about sight loss because you live in it, and you're not, and you get to learn about other people. And it was a good grounding, and it allowed me to apply for other jobs. And I managed to get a job in employment awareness coordinator with Action for Blind People. And I was basically raising awareness issues of sight loss and speaking to employers and trying to then get people to understand the importance of giving people with sight loss chances to work and telling them what we can and can't do. And it taught me all about it. I got to understand about access to work and about the support that you can have within employment. But when I started doing the role, I was doing it for maybe 6 months, and I found it wasn't really for me. I wanted something different. And again, I got back onto Jim. And I think the important thing is I had somebody I could trust, somebody I could confide in, somebody I can speak to, and somebody who'd shown some confidence in my abilities, and asked him for some more advice. And he said to me, well, we're looking to employ our first fundraising manager. Would you be interested in applying for the role? It'll be advertised shortly. And I said, I've never done it before. The only fundraising I'd ever done was in school, when you do sponsored spells and sponsored silences and things like that. But he said, no, he said, I've been a fundraising manager for R&IB in times gone by. He said, I can support you. If you're interested in the role, I believe you've got the personality. I'm looking for somebody with sight loss to do it. I think you could certainly be good at the role if you were interested. So I had to think about it and thought, yeah, this is a career path I'd like to take. So I started doing, I'd learned how to use a computer. As I say, I was using JAWS at that point, and I'd learned what the internet could do for me. And so I started to research what a fundraiser manager could do and would do in community fundraising. And applied for the job, really put a lot of work into the interview. I thought that was important, to put a lot of work into the application form, a lot of work into the preparation for the interview, and made sure that I left no stone unturned so that I would be successful in getting that job. And I was successful and employed as Bradbury Fields' first fundraiser manager. And my role then was to generate income from any source, basically. So it was all aspects of community fundraising, including raffles, store collections, street collections, organising events, galas, dinners, fundraising evenings, as well as selling braille transcription to local businesses, recording onto audio, and also selling and delivering visual awareness training. So it gave me a real grounding into fundraising and all aspects of it. And I was at Bradbury Fields for 5 years and really enjoying the role. But I spotted a role with RNIB, so it's 5 years after I'd been at Bradbury Fields, and I seen a role as a trust fundraiser with RNIB. And one part of the Bradbury Fields role as a community-based fundraiser, which was a lot of selling, I found that I needed a lot of support to do the job, and so I was using a lot of support with the support worker, also volunteers, and I was finding some aspects of the job quite difficult to do independently. Seeing this job with RNIB, and I thought, yeah, I can do that. I still need support to be able to do the aspects of the job that I'm unable to do. Support with research and support with checking that things are laid out, but it was all written work. So I applied for the job with RNIB, and again, put a lot of work into the application process, a lot of research into what a trust fundraiser does, because I'd only written a few trust funding bids when I was with Bradbury Fields, hadn't written many, a couple of lottery bids I've been successful with. But again, applied for the job with RNIB and was successful, got the role. And I started with RNIB back in 2008, and I've been here now for 10 years, thoroughly enjoy it and don't really want to go anywhere else. And I think the important thing to point out to people is that there is support out there. It's difficult to find employment. Nobody doubts that. We know the unemployment rate is really high, at somewhere between 70 and 75%. But my advice would always be, find people you can speak to. I found that person in gym that I could speak to, I could get the advice from, and who then was on the end of the phone. Those people are available either in your local society if you phone up for advice, or, you know, call RNIB, see if there's anybody available that you can chat to. There are people out there who can chat to you and advise, but then you've then got to get the courage to go on and either get the qualifications you need, get the experience you need, get some work experience, undertake a volunteering role. But I do believe we can all get into employment if we show that willpower and tenacity and take on board the advice. I think there's a job for everybody.
If Glenn's story has inspired you, then do search for RNIB Connect Radio on Facebook to join the conversation, and also for the latest news from the blind and partially sighted community. Just search for RNIB Connect Radio on facebook.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at RNIB Radio.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
VI Talk is an interactive social network for visually impaired people. It's a chance to reach out and connect with other blind or partially sighted people, not only online, but in person on Link Days. Roland Myers has been finding out more about VI Talk.
VI Talk, which started in 2014, describes itself as an interactive social network for blind and partially sighted people. Their main aim is to enable vision impaired people to meet up in online groups and from time to time face to face to share experiences and exchange knowledge and helpful information, all loosely about things connected with living with sight loss. A lot of what they do is online, with podcasts of interviews on a wide range of topics, 7 different discussion groups on Facebook, and a presence on Twitter and LinkedIn and elsewhere, not to mention their newly revamped website. And growing out of that online contact are the increasing number of link days that they're now running, gatherings in different places in Britain where people can meet up and again provide mutual support and gather and share useful information. And as their co-founder Joe Fishwick told us, the charity's tagline probably sums up best what they're about.
The tagline for VI Talk is sharing ideas, information and support. And I think on the groups, that's definitely the way it goes. You know, people can ask those questions that people think are daft, but they're actually not. You know, when you're losing your sight, you want that support, that peer support from people who've been there, you know. But we also started doing link days, which are in different areas of the country and enable blind and partially sighted people to come together, listen to speakers, but also get to know each other and, again, get peer support, but actually in the same room, if you will, not online.
So you will actually gather somewhere and carry on the discussion on a, well, on a face-to-face basis, literally?
Yeah, we've had one in Birmingham, one in Liverpool and one in London. They're not a huge event, so normally between sort of 20 and 30 people getting together and listening to, say, about three speakers. And then there's a chance for people to ask questions, but also a chance for people to share their stories as well.
Now, I'm wondering what your take is on the spread of use of the internet for blind and partially sighted people. What kind of following do you think the internet has in terms of kind of usage, the way that you're using it for blind and partially sighted people these days?
On our main group on Facebook, I mean, we've got a book club, sports group, travel group, lots of different things going on. We've just recently opened a music group and an arts and crafts group. But on the main group, we've got over 2,800 members. But we are aware that the internet isn't for everybody, of course, which is why the link days are so important. And we do try and advertise those in lots of different places, not just online, so that hopefully people who aren't quite as technically minded or just don't like the internet, you know, there are people who just don't want to be involved with the internet. So hopefully they'll be able to hear about the events as well and get involved.
And you've done so much since you started. It seems to be growing at a kind of accelerating rate. Have you got plans for the future? Are you going to kind of keep expanding the different things you do? I'm thinking both on online with the different groups that you've created about different topics related to living with sight loss, but also your link days, your meetup days.
Yeah, the plan is, funding permitting, obviously, that we'll hold four link days in 2019 in areas of the country that we've not yet covered. We've got plans to hopefully work with New College Worcester for one of those events so that we can target younger people and maybe parents of young people. So, yeah, lots of plans for the future, but obviously it's always funding permitting.
And for more information about VI Talk, joining them, and importantly, joining in, you can always give them a call on 0161 298 8255. That's 0161 298 8255. Or they can be emailed at info@vitalk, that's vitalk.co.uk. You can ask for more details about their various online groups and podcasts and get the details of their 2019 link days as the plans for those unfold throughout the year. Once again, VI Talk can be found on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/VI Talk, on Twitter at VI Talk Podcast, on Audio Boom, and on the British Wireless Sonata Plus Audio Player Radio. And they also produce a bi-monthly newsletter, which you can subscribe to.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
That's it for another Daily Connect podcast from RNIB Connect Radio. There will be a brand new podcast with you every weeknight just after 5 p.m, so please make sure you subscribe. In the meantime, thank you so much for your company. Stay in the conversation with the Daily Connect.
The Daily Connect podcast.